Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Middle East Studies. I'm James Dorsey, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Stephen Tankel about his new book, With Us and Against Us, How America's Partners Help and Hinder the War on Terror. Stephen Tankel, welcome to the show.
James, thank you so much for having me on.
It's a pleasure to have you. I wonder if you could begin by telling us a little bit about yourself personally, your intellectual history.
Absolutely. So I am an academic at American University in the School of International Service. I'm also a adjunct senior fellow at the Center for New American Security. To talk about my intellectual history is in some ways to really tell the story of how this book came about. When I returned to do my PhD in the War Studies Department at King's College London, I settled upon a topic that looked at how and really why jihadist groups, for lack of a better term, that were in existence at the time of 9/11, but organizationally independent from al-Qaeda, did or did not adopt its global agenda. And I was, you know, very much focused on terrorism at the time, and also primarily on the Middle East. I'd lived in Egypt. I studied language in Syria. But one of my three cases was in Pakistan. It was Lashkar-e-Taiba. And I was just really fascinated by the group. And they, of course, are the group responsible for the 2008 Mumbai attacks, which took place right before I made my first long trip to Pakistan and then to India for field research. And I came back with far more than I needed for a case study. So I ended up taking a break from my PhD. I ended up with far more on Lashkar-e-Taiba than I needed for a case study for a PhD. And my supervisor encouraged me to put my dissertation on hold and to write a book about LAT, which I did. And through that, I became much more involved in security issues in South Asia. So, you know, I didn't let the Middle East focus go, but I became very involved in looking at political and military and security issues in South Asia. I finished the book. I finished my dissertation, which remained on that subject. And I started working at American University when I finished my PhD. And I thought that I would turn my PhD into what would then be my second book. But I continued to work on South Asia, and that resulted in my being invited to come in and work as a senior advisor at the Department of Defense in what is called the Office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. So I was the senior advisor for Asia and Pacific Security Affairs, working primarily on U.S. defense policy in South and Central Asia. And I had made a lot of progress turning my book, which I thought was going to be primarily about how jihadist groups evolved and the influence of states on their evolution, into a book. But I came out from that experience much more, I wouldn't say interested, but aware of the importance of partner nations in how we pursue our security policies, especially in the counterterrorism space, and how some of these partners can be very, very difficult, how they can simultaneously help and hinder our efforts. And I thought that was both a more interesting question By 2015, when I came out of DOD, and a more important one from a policy perspective. So I had about 80% of my book done, and I called the editor-in-chief for Columbia University Press, series on terrorism and insurgency, and I said, you know, I'd like to start almost from scratch, and it's going to take me a couple more years to do it. And to his credit, it was Bruce Hoffman. He said, you know, you should do what you think is going to be the best book you can write. And so, you know, I'm still very much a terrorism person, but I've become much more interested recently in counterterrorism, in security assistance and cooperation with other countries, in the changing nature of alliances and partnerships themselves, and what the United States could do to get more out of some of its partners. And that's really at the heart of the book that I've written. And I think, you know, very much the title gives it away, With Us and Against Us, How Partner Nations Help and Hinder the War on Terror. The idea that a lot of America's critical partners, in this case, in terms of counterterrorism, are simultaneously helpful and hurtful. Now, that's true of any ally, but I think it is much more true today with countries that are not allies, you know, that are just partners where we don't have a treaty alliance. And it is much more true with issues like terrorism, where the threat is often external for the United States, but internal for the country that we're dealing with, and where the solutions are not just military, but also very often go to the heart of the nature of a country's polity. And so that's sort of where I, you know, a lot of where my research is going today.
You obviously have the great advantage that you've both looked at this as an academic, but also as a government official, and have therefore seen both sides of the coin. I mean, what strikes me, and it's an excellent book, and congratulations on that. What strikes me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there really are, I guess, three underlying themes, in a sense, in terms when you look at cooperation with countries that have been problematic, like Pakistan, like Saudi Arabia, are problematic at least from a U.S. perspective. One is just simply, what is terrorism? Definitions of what is terrorism, and definitions of, in terms of using violence or force, and whether or not that has to be exclusively a state organization, with other words, a military, an intelligence service, a law enforcement, or whether non-state actors are legitimate actors. The second thing that I think comes out of this book is just very different perceptions. You know, you talk about the paradigm shift post 9/11. Where the U.S. perception of political violence, terrorism, changed, but it didn't change on the other side of the equation. And the third thing that struck me, and this may be my conclusion, was that to really not only manage the partnership ultimately, but also to try and resolve problems, you're really talking about resolving either domestic issues or interstate relations, for example, in the case of India and Pakistan. But that strikes me as the three really underlying themes of the book that you then illustrate extremely well in case studies.
Thank you. Yeah, so I think those themes are definitely prevalent. And, you know, it's always great for me to hear how other people have interpreted sort of what I was trying to put forward. And I think the three areas that you identify get at the heart of a lot of that. And I would take each one in turn. The first is, for me, you know, the definition of terrorism is something when I teach my students, I always tell them, you know, in the class that I teach on terrorism and counterterrorism, that we are not going to spend the semester trying to define terrorism, because people have been trying to do that for decades upon decades, and nobody can come to agreement. The United States government can't even come to agreement within itself over what terrorism is. And so I think that's been an issue that's been with us for a long time. One of the things I think I was trying to put across was the idea that the, one of the ideas I was trying to put across in terms of the definition, you know, when one talks about definitions of terrorism, and I didn't get into it too much in terms of the definition itself, was the broader idea that this is political violence. And I have a line in there that is, and I'm of course paraphrasing, you know, that essentially says when we talk about counterterrorism, we tend to get caught up in the mechanics of it. We tend to think about this very mechanistically. But it's important to remember that what we are trying to counter is political violence. The reason why we've had so much trouble defining terrorism is because it's such a political hot button problem. Terrorism is something that is so hard to define because of the politics that are wrapped up in it. And yet we sometimes think about counterterrorism as if it could be sanitized and devoid of politics. And so one of the things that I was really trying to put forward is that counterterrorism, for all the importance that can and should be placed on professional communities working together, and relationships between intelligence services and militaries and diplomats and what have you, that ultimately this is a political issue. If we're going to counter terrorism, politics is going to come into play, and we cannot escape that. So that really for me was a really big theme, and I think that your point about the definitions of terrorism and violence, is a very important piece of that. The second theme that you identified, I think, is spot on, and it is that issue of perceptions. And, you know, one of the things I write about is that the United States tends to be very, very focused, understandably, on its own threat perceptions. And so it sees a terrorist group and it spends a lot of time doing threat assessments to decide what kind of threat that group poses and how big a threat it poses. But then very often what I've seen happen after that, and people I've spoken to in other policy positions have affirmed for me, is that when it comes to looking for cooperation from partners, the United States will have assessed the threat and then goes to the partner and says, here's what we need or here's what we want. And here's what we're prepared to give you in return for that. But what we don't do is spend nearly enough time, at least in my opinion, trying to account for how the partner perceives that threat. And I get into different ways in which that's problematic, in my writing in the book. One of them is that we straight up can disagree over whether or not a group is a threat. We can disagree, over whether or not a group poses a threat internally or externally. I would point to Pakistan and the way it views groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba and the Taliban, where it sees these groups as allies and we see them as threats. That's a really wide variance. But even in areas where we share threats, where the United States shares threats with other countries, there can be divergences. And as I note in the book, U.S. counterterrorism policies write a lot about shared threats and this idea that we should be able to cooperate with another country if we share a threat from a terrorist group with them. But my point is, it's not just whether you share that threat, it's how you prioritize that threat relative to other threats, and it's how you perceive that threat. And I think, Yemen under the regime of Ali Abdullah Saleh is a really good example. Both the United States and the Saleh regime shared a threat from AQAP. But for the United States, that was by 2010, the biggest terrorist threat in the world. For Saleh, it was a distant third to the threat from Houthi rebels and from a separatist movement in southern Yemen. Saudi Arabia is another example. No question that since 2003, at least, the United States and the Saudis have shared a threat from Al-Qaeda. But at various times, the Saudis have been considerably more concerned about the Iranians than they have about Al-Qaeda. And all of that is going to impact the type of cooperation that other countries are going to provide to the United States and the type of cooperation the United States is going to seek from other countries. The ISIS coalition, I think, is another great example. You had all of these countries that came together that agreed that ISIS was a threat. But if you look at some of the key players, the Saudis were arguably more concerned about Iran. The Turks were are arguably more concerned about the Kurds. A lot of the different countries involved didn't prioritize the ISIS threat. And so while the coalition was able to make progress rolling ISIS back militarily, now you're seeing that coalition fraying and may not be able to sustain those gains because the other threats they were more concerned about are rising to the fore. And I would go even further and note that even where the United States and a partner can agree on the prioritization of the threat, they may perceive the threat differently. This is a podcast on new books in the Middle East. Egypt, arguably one of the key players in the Middle East, and a critical counterterrorism partner for the United States. The United States and the Egyptians can agree on the jihadist threat in terms of priorities. It's a top threat for them. It's a top threat for the United States. But for the United States, that threat does not include, at least from a policy perspective, the Muslim Brotherhood. And for the Egyptians, it most certainly does. And so they perceive that threat differently. And the way the Egyptians are going about counterterrorism, I would argue, is ultimately bad for them, and by extension, could potentially be bad for the United States. So even those threat perceptions are important. And I think your final point, about both the domestic and the international aspect is spot on. And that's something that's changed since 9/11. The United States is now both more interested in the domestic affairs of many countries and long-standing regional conflicts, like the conflict between India and Pakistan, the conflict, although it doesn't rise to the same level, the conflict between Saudi and Iran or the competition between Saudi and Iran, all of these now have greater bearing on the cooperation that the United States can get from other countries and how other countries are going to behave vis-a-vis terrorist threats. And that's real difficult because the United States is now asking more of its partners than it ever has in the past when it comes to counterterrorism. And I think one of the challenges for the United States is recognizing where it's going to be able to get useful cooperation that is sustainable and where it's not and where it's going to have to be pragmatic and maybe sort of take half a loaf of bread rather than hoping for the whole loaf. And for me, optimizing cooperation where it's good, mitigating it where it's bad, knowing where because of domestic politics or because of a longstanding regional conflict, you're not going to be able to get the kind of cooperation you want. And then getting the most out of the trade space in between where cooperation is good and where it's not good begins with knowing what to expect from partner nations. And so that for me was really the critical question that I was trying to answer.
It strikes me several things. One is, very fundamentally, what this all really means is that cooperation really can only be successful in a relatively narrow band. And it also seems to me that that's problematic, particularly if you take countries like Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, which has long had as its basic ideology and social and cultural and religious system, a very ultra-conservative, austere interpretation of Islam, even though that is changing. Or a country like Pakistan, where, well, because of a long history of struggling with is, you see that ultra-conservatism and ultra-conservative attitudes are really woven into the fabric of society and the fabric of institutions, including very crucial institutions of the state. And while ultra-conservatism is not, by definition, violent, it often does create this environment of intolerance, of maybe even supremacism, and therefore, potentially, when several things come together, becomes a breeding ground. So that, in a sense, I think, also complicates the whole issue of counterterrorism and narrows the band in which you can cooperate. The other thing is also that you know, in a lot of these states, Turkey, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, for the longest period of time, they definitely wanted to cooperate with the United States, wanted close relationships with the United States, and yet a popular sense of anti-Americanism was also something that was very convenient for them. And they used that in terms of legitimizing their regimes.
Yeah, no, I certainly taking that last point first, there's no question that cooperation with the United States is often not popular. It's something that governments do because they want to maintain those relationships with the United States. It is not popular on, on the so-called street. And it's certainly the case that in some of these countries, governments or security services or militaries, in the case of Pakistan, deliberately stoke that anti-American sentiment, with one hand while cozying up to the United States, on the other hand. And that's done for a variety of reasons. It helps them sort of put off tough requests because they can point to, anger on the street. No, we can help you on this area, but we can't help you on that area because it's going to anger our population. But I would also say it's the case that sometimes you get cooperation that is quite good, but hidden because of anti-Americanism that in some cases, again, governments or security services have stoked and in other cases have not. One of the things that I note is that, countries are more apt to cooperate on things like intelligence sharing or the provision of access for U.S. forces in small numbers or for drone strikes in some cases or for the transit of military supplies or through a country's airspace, either for supply or for airstrikes in another country. They're more prone to cooperate in those areas of access or in intelligence cooperation or on things like rendition, which is the extrajudicial transfer of prisoners or access to detainees for several reasons. One, and this goes to your point about that, that anti-Americanism that often exists in the population, some of these things are just easier to conceal than other areas of cooperation. It's very hard to conceal conducting counterterrorism operations, by law enforcement or the military, if you're the partner in question, right? That's hard to hide. It's very hard to hide joining a regional coalition. But it's much easier to hide intelligence cooperation. Pakistan tried to hide its provision of access for drone strikes. It tried to hide the fact that it was providing a base to the United States for drones until almost, a decade after 9/11. The Saudis were very quiet about their provision of a base for drones. They are not advertising the intelligence cooperation they do with the United States. None of these countries are talking a lot about their participation in rendition. So these are all things that are easier to conceal. They are also things that are more in line with traditional bilateral cooperation. You can sign deals for access. Intelligence services can have a long history of working with one another. You can, when you're cooperating on detainees, it's very easy to have a quid pro quo. I've done rendition and it provided this guy to you and you've provided somebody to me, which is why the United States was able to, cooperate on rendition with Syria up until about 2005. All of these things are more tactical. They are more transactional. And so they lend themselves to cooperation, even in areas where threat perceptions aren't necessarily as strong. They are the areas where U.S. instruments of statecraft, including the allure of that relationship that you are speaking about, has the most value. But of course, right? As you noted, that's not as wide a band of cooperation as the United States is going to want in many cases. I'm not sure I would say that cooperation is always confined to narrow bands with these countries. But what I would say is that very often what you get is you get a positive band of cooperation and a negative band where, you know, a country is engaging in behavior that is distinctly unhelpful. So Saudi Arabia, I would say the band of cooperation on intelligence and access and Saudi's commitment to policing its own territory, at least after 2003, which is when Al-Qaeda began launching attacks in the kingdom, all of that has been quite robust. I don't think that has been narrow by any means. But unfortunately, you know, while Saudi cooperation in terms of domestic counterterrorism operations, to include even efforts to combat terrorist financing, which, although still far from perfect, are much more robust now than they were 15, 16 years ago, and intelligence cooperation, all of that, there's been quite a lot there, really, you know, over the last decade and a half. But unfortunately, at the same time, the Saudis have simultaneously done a whole lot to export Wahhabism, which, you know, although, as you noted, you know, an ultra conservative, you know, brand of Islam is not, you know, does not necessarily translate into terrorism, has, I think, at the very least, been the mood music to which a lot of the jihadists have danced. I mean, not for nothing that after ISIS took territory and wanted to administer schools and didn't have its own books, it just used books from the Saudi system. You know, so the Saudis have been exporting, you know, Wahhabism for decades. They have, you know, been encouraging people to go fight on foreign fronts for decades. And more recently, they've been engaged in, you know, an intervention in Yemen, which arguably makes the fight against AQAP more difficult, although a recent report suggests AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, for those not familiar with the acronym, haven't necessarily been able to take advantage of the conflict as much as some of us had feared. So, you know, I would say that sometimes you do get these narrow bands of cooperation, but sometimes what one gets is broad cooperation in one area and but also really broad bad behavior in other areas.
Sorry. I think what I meant with a narrow band, absolutely true. There is cooperation, and the Saudis have kicked in once it really became a threat to them with the Al-Qaeda attacks in 2003, 2004. But the question that is in my mind is to what degree that cooperation in some ways is fundamentally countered and maybe even neutralized by the broader issues. So you look at Egypt, where there is actual agreement on the priority of what's going on in the Sinai, for example. But overall policy in Egypt, the degree of repression, the inability to deliver economically and socially, creates an environment in which you may get a generation that has nothing more to lose. You know, in Syria and Yemen, you have generations that are going to grow up hating, whether it's the Saudis, or in the case of the Syrians, probably the rest of the world. Or you get situations like you had going back to the early 1990s in Saudi Arabia, where when you had U.S. troops there, they hired militant Islamic scholars to acculturalize U.S. soldiers, converted larger numbers of them to Islam, and then tried to dispatch them to Bosnia to fight with the Bosnian Muslims against the Serbs. So, with other words, what you do with one hand, in some ways, gets destroyed by the other hand.
Yeah, I think that's 100% correct, and that is the paradox of these partnerships. You know, and again, I go back to that idea that all allies are helpful in some ways and hurtful in others, but it is just so much more exaggerated when the United States is dealing with countries that, quite frankly, it has very little in common with, in many respects. Some of these countries are longstanding partners because they've been important for security reasons. Saudi Arabia is one of them. Egypt is another. Others are countries with whom the United States has formed partnerships almost exclusively for the purposes of counterterrorism. The United States had no security relationship with Yemen before 9/11. We had people there investigating the USS Cole attack, but it didn't have a real security relationship. It didn't have a real security relationship with Algeria. Or with Mali, which are other countries that I write about in the book, and it formed those for the purposes of countering terrorism. And with these types of countries, I think you're absolutely right that much of what is done good on one side is undone on the other. And that's really, like I said, I mean the title gives it away, with us and against us, how partners help and hinder. And it is this idea that many of these partners, or many of these partnerships are paradoxical. And then the key becomes recognizing that, but also moving beyond it to say, okay, well, if that's the case, what can we expect? And how could we make the most of these partnerships, recognizing that they are never going to be as good as the United States wants them to. And I think that's also important, is to recognize that these partnerships are never going to be perfect. It is always going to be a case of just trying to get to as good as it gets. But that means you have to know what as good as it gets is, and that requires answering the question, what can we expect from them? And that's what I really tried to do. And I did that. You'd mentioned those perceptions before, and I did that in several ways. The first was by looking at how the United States and the partner in question prioritized and perceived both the terrorist threat in question, and other threats in relation to that terrorist threat. And then also looking at how the partner perceived that terrorist threat in terms of both its usefulness and the threat. So you can have terrorist groups that a partner sees as low utility, high threat. Well, they have a belligerent relationship like the Egyptians do. And they are not going to need to be incentivized to conduct counterterrorism operations. So the United States does not have to worry about incentivizing Egypt. Sometimes we think, I think in the United States, that if security assistance declines or the United States pressures Egypt too hard, that Egyptian counterterrorism operations are going to decline. And that's probably not the case. They're going to do it regardless because it's in their interests to do it. That's a very different situation than the Pakistanis and the Haqqani network, where it's high usefulness to the state and low threat. Unless the Pakistanis were to turn on the Haqqani network, which is, one of the most lethal arms of the Taliban insurgency in Afghanistan, and try to attack them, which the Pakistanis are not going to do because they don't want to turn what is a useful ally for them into a threat. And in that case, no amount of security assistance that the United States provides is going to change the Pakistani strategic calculus. And then you have other situations where groups can be low threat and low utility or high threat and high utility, what my students would refer to as frenemies, where you're again going to get different types of return on investment in terms of what you're providing with regards to security assistance and cooperation or your use of soft power or the allure of your relationship. And so the key is to recognize that these different permutations exist, and also to recognize that counterterrorism is not a one-size-fits-all policy. Some of my academic colleagues, when I was writing the book, sort of pressed me to try to quantify that. They said, Stephen, can you rank, on a scale of 1 to 3 or 1 to 5 or 1 to 10, how these partners are good or bad partners. And I said, no, I couldn't do that because the United States doesn't want the same things from every country. Every country does not have the same, the same level of threat emanating from it in terms of terrorist groups. The United States is more prepared to use coercion or incentives with some countries than with others. And so it's also critical to recognize that when we talk about counterterrorism, we're talking about is the partner conducting domestic counterterrorism operations? Are these counterterrorism operations consistent or inconsistent? Are they sustainable over time? Are they being done in accordance with laws of war? One would argue that the Egyptians, as you noted, are not. They are engaging in widespread human rights violations that's probably incubating the next generation of jihadists. But that's just one bucket. A second bucket are those types of tactical cooperation that I referred to earlier: access, intelligence cooperation, cooperation on detainees. Then you have a third bucket, which is cooperation on the regional sphere. Is a country contributing to a coalition? Is it helping to try to settle a civil conflict where terrorists are taking advantage of that strife to embed themselves, and develop safe haven? Or is it making that civil conflict worse, like the Saudis are doing in Yemen? And then you have a fourth category. You talked about those domestic issues before. Is a country engaging in the types of reforms necessary and the types of policies and programs necessary to reduce the risk factors for terrorism to begin with, right? Preventative measures that go to keeping people from becoming radicalized and becoming terrorists. Those are all different forms of cooperation. And depending on those threat perceptions, depending on the usefulness of the group, depending on a host of political factors, and I can't stress enough how inherently political counterterrorism and counterterrorism cooperation is, the United States is going to be able to expect different things from different countries. And I go through and I posit propositions in the book, some of which I've mentioned here, but to a much more extensive nature. And my point is that what the United States needs to do is it needs to recognize what it can expect from its partners. And once it does that, well, now maybe you can be tougher on Egypt in some areas because you're not so worried that they're going to stop conducting domestic counterterrorism operations. And with the Pakistanis, you're not going to try to buy their cooperation against the Haqqanis because you recognize that that's not possible. And so you're not going to waste billions of dollars and years trying to do that and build up expectations only to have them dashed and contribute to bitterness in the relationship, because you've assessed at the outset that that's not going to happen. And you've gone into this, sort of with a, if you'll forgive, a pop culture movie reference, sort of a Godfather perspective on this, which is it's just business. It's not personal.
Sorry. You obviously, and you've seen this in practical experience, governments basically have a field of tension, or the United States in this case, in terms of its broader policies, its broader values, and simply what is realistically possible in terms of achieving a specific goal. But the question that arises in my mind, if that doesn't, in a sense, render counterterrorism to being a band-aid solution. And what I mean by that is there's no doubt post-2003, 2004, Saudi Arabia and the United States agreed on the priority of al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda was a threat, and it needed to be neutralized, if not destroyed. Let's say they had succeeded. The United States, so al-Qaeda had been wiped off the face of the earth. The problem would still exist. So at the same time, Saudi Arabia in the 1980s, 1990s was supporting groups like Sipah Sahaba, which were virulently anti-Shiite and attacking Shiites and Iranian targets. And until today, they are supporting a more violent offshoot of the group, Lashkar-e-Jhangvi, in Balochistan. And they've pumped enormous amounts of money into that. So with other words, you saw, or the Islamic State, which has been seriously weakened, but still is capable of launching all kinds of attacks. And so the question really arises whether counterterrorism is sort of like a firefighter. You put out this fire, but you're creating or potentially creating another fire. And so you keep on putting out these fires rather than trying to resolve a fundamental problem.
Yeah, and I think there's strong awareness of that in the counterterrorism policy and practitioner community, that I think there's an understandable, and I think it's right, acceptance of the fact that you may never be able to get rid of the problem entirely. I think this idea that the United States can defeat terrorism and every terrorist group is, you know, very wrong-headed. And the key is doing enough to keep U.S. citizens and, you know, the United States safe and protect U.S. interests, and doing it in a way that also, you know, contributes to the overall security and stability of the countries with whom the United States is partnering. Keeping in mind that the United States has, you know, limited influence in some of these places and, you know, cannot, you know, if the United States could have convinced a lot of countries to engage in political reform or to change their policies, it would have by now. But I think there's a recognition that this is not something that's ever going to be entirely defeated, but that we are probably too far to the side of putting out fires, as you say, because even though the United States has not been attacked from abroad since 9/11, you know, the problem has clearly grown and metastasized in many different ways in many different places. And you've got plenty of countries that are less stable now than they were before. And I think in terms of how the role that counterterrorism plays in that really depends in part on how one defines counterterrorism. And there's no agreement on that. For many people, I think counterterrorism has become this very Band-Aid-oriented, mechanistic, you know, thwart the plot, kill the bad guy, you know, gather as much intel as you can. And those things are all important. You know, plots need to be thwarted. And sometimes bad guys need to be killed. And intelligence is absolutely critical. And you know, there's a lot that we need to be doing on the protection side and hardening of physical infrastructure and things like that. But that's only going to keep the threat at bay. And in some places, that's probably the most that can be hoped for, because ultimately the host nation is the decider of what goes on in its territory. But I do believe that the United States can get more out of its partners. And I think part of that begins with recognizing that counterterrorism is fundamentally broader than we often think. And as I, you know, part of this is recognizing its political nature, but part of it is also recognizing that it's not as though everything has become counterterrorism and counterterrorism has become everything. It is to say that a lot of policies and programs that didn't used to touch on counterterrorism objectives now do. Promoting rule of law is not a new thing. The United States was promoting rule of law decades ago. Now, that has counterterrorism connotations. Seeking access isn't a new thing. The United States was seeking military access decades ago, but now it has counterterrorism connotations. And I think one of the areas where the United States has fallen short has been to put too much pressure on those more narrow tactical mechanistic areas of counterterrorism, in part because they are easier to achieve. I write that in the book. They are easier to achieve, but also in part because cooperation in these areas is viewed as more critical in a short-term thwart the plot, kill the bad guy kind of way, right? And there are also these things are easier to measure. Access is easier to measure. Body counts are easier to measure. But the United States has done that at the expense of longer term objectives that you talk about, right? That the problem has not been ameliorated. And I don't think that the United States can change Saudi behavior or Pakistani behavior or Egyptian behavior, but it can try to push in the right directions. And too often pushing in the right directions, I think, has given way to cooperating on areas where the United States can get cooperation, even if it doesn't need that cooperation as much as it thinks it does. And this goes to, I think, a culture of both expediency, because politicians serve 2 or 4 year terms, right? Or in the Senate, 6 year terms. And so you're looking for fast results, but also exaggerated threat perceptions on the US side, or at the very least, this idea that if it's a possible threat, then we have to treat it as an absolute threat, because nobody wants to take risks and potentially have something blow up on their watch. And so there's a preference for short-term, hard security solutions, even if the threat doesn't necessarily warrant it, if there is a threat. And I think we're seeing that with the potential move to go from unarmed UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, or drones in at the base in Niger, to arming those drones, right? 6 months or a year ago, they were going to be unarmed drones, and now 4 U.S. servicemen have been killed in an ambush, and now we need to have armed UAVs in Niger. That's arguably an overreaction to the threat, but it's how the United States is going to respond, because it's how the United States can easily respond.
I want to touch on 2 last things. One is Hamas, the Palestinian Islamist Palestinian group in the Gaza Strip, obviously doesn't feature in your book, but in some ways it's indicative of the problem. I mean, with other words, there's no question about it. Hamas are not nice guys. But there's also little question about the fact that if one is ever going to come to an Israeli-Palestinian solution, then Hamas is going to have to be part of that. And if you read Hamas's position on some sort of arrangement with Israel, the position fundamentally comes down to the demand for recognition of Israel as a precondition for negotiations has been tried. It's been tried with Oslo. It was tried with the process when Arafat in 1988 recognized Israel, and 25, 30 years later, it hasn't produced anything. So the whole question then becomes also in terms of counterterrorism strategy, designating Hamas as a terrorist organization, cutting it off financially and economically, hasn't brought it to the table. And the question then is, whether or not counterterrorism really has to not be embedded in far broader policies if it's really going to be effective. And the second issue I wanted to bring up, which is in your book, and you've alluded to in many ways during this conversation, which is that you've also, in a sense, had a paradigm shift with the end of the Cold War. So during the Cold War, it was black and white. It was all very, very clear. Whereas post-Cold War, it's become much more complex and, in a sense, much more messy.
Yeah. So let me take the Hamas one first. And I'll have less to say on that just because I'm not a Hamas expert. And so I'm always leery of wading too far in where I don't have the data and the on the ground experience to support what I have to say. I think this is certainly a case where if there was ever an example of counterterrorism being, the politics of counterterrorism, it's U.S. policy towards Hamas. I think we can all agree that the current policies have not brought Hamas to the table and are unlikely to do so anytime soon. And one needs to look no farther than Europe to see, I think, legitimate disagreements over how to treat the group. I see Hamas as a terrorist organization. I believe that it is, and I also believe that it is, the elected or was elected to lead in Gaza. This was part of the problem with the Freedom Agenda, is that the United States was pushing during the first years after 9/11, is you encourage elections and then you have to live with the outcome of those elections, and you have a legitimately elected government in Hamas, which is also a terrorist organization, which I think like I said, throws into stark relief the political nature of this.
If I can throw something in here, I mean, in a sense, this goes back to whatever one thought of George W. Bush. He fairly quickly after 9/11, and that's what led to the Freedom Agenda and the Democracy Project, which was when he recognized that 9/11 had occurred not just simply because of Saudi support for Wahhabism, militancy, what have you, but also because the United States for the longest period of time had opted for stability rather than political change that would lead to more more free, more liberal societies.
Yes, I think that he was not incorrect in diagnosing part of the problem. Unfortunately, pushing democracy is not, an immediate shift to democracy is not necessarily the solution to that problem. There's a really strong body of research that shows that you don't want that democratic transitions, when they happen, are often messy and violent, and that they are more prone to be messy and violent if you have not built a base or a foundation first of reasonable governance, adherence to rule of law, and things of that nature. Holding elections does not make a country democratic. I mean, that is, they may be even free and fair elections. That is not a strong democracy. A strong democracy is a democracy that also has governance, that has rule of law, that has strong civilian institutions, that is respectful of human rights, all of those things. And there was not a lot of that involved with the Freedom Agenda. There was also not a lot involved with addressing, many of the other, risk factors for terrorism. So I commend the recognition of the need for political reform, but I thought that the prescription for political reform was incomplete. And then, of course, the approach to actually achieving that political reform was not executed uniformly at all. There was some pressure on Egypt, and then that pressure pretty much receded. The United States at no time tried to pressure Pakistan to hold free and fair elections when it was, being ruled by a military dictator who'd taken power in a coup 2 years before 9/11. There were plenty of other places where the United States did not push that hard. And so I think you're absolutely right that Bush was correct to recognize the need to rebalance that trade-off that was being made between stability and values and political reform. I thought that the way it was gone about was really incredibly far from perfect. And I thought the Obama administration got it a bit more right. And I should say for the record, I was at the Department of Defense under Obama, but I was not a political appointee. I was there as an expert hire. So, I'm really trying to say this as much as a scholar as anything, is that what the Obama administration I thought did well was recognize the need not to push democracy so hard rhetorically, but rather to quietly try to encourage better governance, better rule of law to create that foundation. But of course, that takes, all of this takes years and years and years of commitment. And the United States, not under Bush and not under Obama, and certainly not under Donald Trump, has never prioritized these types of political reforms over other objectives with these countries, and has never stuck to one set of policies long enough to achieve these types of ends. So, Yeah, I mean, that's you know, I think your point about the freedom agenda is quite valid, but you know, that's I think those are some of the ways in which I would round that out. You know, back to Hamas, I wouldn't have too much more to say there, other than to say that I think it's possible to both argue that Hamas is a terrorist organization, and to recognize that peace is not made with one's enemies, and that ultimately, if there's to be any type of an Israeli-Palestinian accord, which, you know, although I don't follow this closely, I am less and less confident of, not that I was ever all that confident, you know, other than I guess at a few high points when one could be hopeful. You know, it is going to revolve around, you know, the two enemies engaging with one another, and one would hope that the United States would play a constructive role in that when the time comes. To your other question or note about the big change in that paradigm shift since the Cold War. Sure, absolutely. You know, I would just say that there's no question that a lot of these countries recognize that a terrorist threat exists, but they perceive that threat differently. They often prioritize that threat differently than the United States has. After the Cold War ended, the United States was without a security paradigm. 9/11 provided one, but it provided one for the United States. It did not provide one for a lot of these other countries. They were reacting to the US. They continued to face many of the other threats, internal or external or both, that they had faced before. And so what the United States was seeking from them was both more extensive in the counterterrorism space than the United States had ever sought from any country in terms of counterterrorism, and more extensive than what it had sought from these countries specifically during the Cold War, when they were not frontline states, countries in Middle East, Africa, and South Asia, which are the case studies in the book, Egypt, Algeria, Yemen, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Mali, all of which we've talked about during the last hour. And so, you know, that lack of paradigm shift for these other countries was, I think, you know, really critical and something that was in some ways missed from a U.S. perspective. Now, the U.S. paradigm is beginning to shift. The latest national defense strategy states that the main priority for the United States is great power competition with China and Russia, primarily, and then secondarily with rogue regimes like Iran and North Korea. Terrorism is another threat, but it is not the top threat. And as somebody who studies and works on terrorism and counterterrorism for a living, my response to that was, it's about time. Counterterrorism should not be the defining feature of the U.S. security paradigm. It should not drive U.S. foreign policy. And I think this is an area where the United States actually can do less with more. But here I would say, if the United States is going to focus on great power competition, which it should, if it is going to focus on rogue regimes, which it should, it has not said it's going to focus on things like climate change, but it should, then that means that the United States is actually going to have to rely even more on its partners than it has in the past, which, you know, I would argue, you know, to make a bid for what I've said in the book, that the United States is going to need to adopt a partner-centric paradigm in terms of how it looks at counterterrorism cooperation to augment the threat-centric paradigm that it already has, right? It already looks at things from a threat perspective. It is going to have to start looking at things from the partner's perspective as well. It's going to have to understand its partners' perspectives, its partners' perceptions, its partners' priorities, if it is going to get more out of these partners, which the United States is going to have to do, because it can't do CT on its own, and it's going to need to rely on other countries as much, if not more, going forward than it has up to this point.
Stephen, your book is so rich that we could go on for another hour. And unfortunately, we've got about a minute and a half left. Thank you very much for this. Where are you going to go from now? What's your next project?
Sure. Well, very briefly, and James, it's been great to talk with you about this. Very briefly, I've got a couple of new projects in the pipeline. One looks at how the United States could work more closely with its European allies and other Western allies on counterterrorism in places like Middle East, Africa, and South Asia, where I think the United States could learn a lot from how some of these countries go about viewing counterterrorism through more of a holistic, fragile states perspective. Another project that I've got in the works, looks at the changing nature of coalitions and how new threats like terrorism, but also new threats from climate change and other things, are changing the ways in which the United States is going to need to cooperate with other countries. And I've got some other ideas in the works as well. But again, going back to where we started, I'm really enamored with some of these issues in terms of how threats have changed and how U.S. partner relations are changing in the process.
Stephen, sounds like a great future for your research. I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. Look forward to having you again on the show once your next book is out, and wish you all the best.
Thank you very much for having me, James. It's been a real pleasure.
The pleasure has been mine. Let me just turn off the recording.